The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Rabban Gamliel and the Yeshiva of Yavna, is the seventh of a 16-part series from Yavna to Beitar. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas David Chai Ben Nissim Olav HaSholem, Mr. David Chai Ganim of Blessed Memory.
Over the last few years, a vast industry has developed in teaching people how to effectively lead. Countless books, articles, seminars, and whole courses have been developed in teaching effective management, how to inspire, how to influence, and sometimes how to psychologically manipulate those who are under you. By contrast, however, very little has been written about what to look for in choosing a leader. What qualities does a leader have to have? In the military and corporate sector, where in all probability future leaders are chosen by the present leaders, people with years of experience, the need for specific guidelines is not very critical. However, in a democratic society where the highest leadership is chosen by a laity, people who have very little experience in leadership, there's a critical but unmet need for having specific guidelines of what to look for in choosing a leader. This problem affects the Jewish community as well. What do you look for in choosing a rabbi? What qualities he's supposed to have? A very interesting story is told of Rav Meir Shapiro. Meir Shapiro was the chief rabbi of Lublin in Poland, and he was the dean and founder of the Yeshivas Chachme Lublin, the great yeshiva in Lublin. Even though Lithuania had had yeshivas for, I'm referring to a yeshiva as a formal institution similar to a college, with a syllabus, with dormitory facilities, with tests, that kind of institution, even though it was common in Lithuania, did not exist in Poland. Torah was studied far and wide, but in informal capacity. There were shtiblach, there was these little shuls or little koilels that one studied on his own, one's own pace. But to have a yeshiva that would have hundreds of bochurim, hundreds of students in one building, was something new. Poland didn't have that. And Meir Shapiro felt that such an institution was critical for the survival of Torah in Poland. And he knocked door to door trying to get support for this idea of having a formal yeshiva. One of the people that he approached questioned him and asked him, Rabbi, after all, what do you want to produce in your yeshiva? What's the purpose? You want to make a rabbinical seminary? You have room for 400 Because there are not 400 slots for rabbis in all of Poland. Even though there are many positions, but they're already taken. How many future positions will open up? I mean, you're creating a school for 400. So Meir Shapiro answered him, says, out of that 400, 4 or 5 will be rabbis. But the rest will be mevinim, will be experts on what to look for in choosing a rabbi. So it was worth it to have the whole yeshiva just to have a laity who knew what to look for. It would seem that the closest parallel in the qualities of leadership is the qualities one looks for in a shidduch, in looking for a mate. There's a Gemara in Tainus, Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph, in 31a, that lists various factors in a shidduch. One are those qualities that could easily be discerned, the attraction, the beauty. There are other factors that are internal factors. The idea of creating a marriage l'shem shamayim, creating a marriage for the sake of heaven, with focused goals, with a higher vision. The idea of integrity and vision is something that's not easily apparent. And there's a third factor which is mentioned, and that of family. What family they come from? Family plays an enormous influence on the formation of one's character. We find these three factors in slightly different form in choosing a leader for the Jewish community as well. There's the qualities that are readily apparent. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, in Peches Amud Beis, in 88b, that describes the qualifications in looking for a judge, to fill a judgeship. The person must be a chacham, must be wise, must be a shval berach, must be humble. It must be, this is das habrias neuchamenu, a person that the opinion of humanity is pleasing to people. After all, he has to interact with people, he's a judge. He has to have a demeanor that people would like and respect. These qualities, the wisdom, the humility, the demeanor, are things that are readily apparent after speaking to a person for 5-10 minutes. You can see them. There are other qualities that are less evident. In this week's Sedra, when Yisrael was giving advice to Moshe, and the qualities one should look for in choosing judges, the qualities that Yisrael chooses are really those that affect one's integrity. The qualifications of wisdom actually for judges are listed in the beginning of Parshas Dvorim, in the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy. But here, in this week's Sedra, this is in Parshas Yisrael, this is in Exodus 18, in verse 21. And the advice for Yisrael is, V'ata sechazeh, you should see to it, look, mikol ha'om, from all of the people, Anshei Chayil are people of independent means that will not be influenced, will not be pressured by prestigious people of the community when these people come in front of the judges, in front of the judges to be for a ruling. Because the judges themselves have an independent source of income, and they're not frightened of any loss due to the adverse reaction from one of the litigants. Yirei Elokim, those who fear God. Anshe Emes, people of truth, people their word is a word. Soine Votza, those who hate ill-begotten gain. In other words, if there's any question about the kashrus, of the money that they have, they will immediately give it up. Rashi quotes the Chazal that if a judge has gone himself through litigation and has lost, it puts the judge's integrity into question. I mean, he lost the case. I mean, there's a good chance that actually he was at fault. He didn't see his own fault. He was blinded by the love of his own money. I can't choose such a person. So there are certain sense, there are rules of integrity. These are much harder these are much harder qualifications. It's hard to discern. Very often it's hard to find. You know, the story is told soon after the creation of the State of Israel, there was a movement underfoot to create a Sanhedrin. It was to recreate the Jewish state and to create a Sanhedrin. Of course, there was much opposition to this, and it never really got off the ground. The Heichal Shlomo, which is the seat of the chief rabbi in Israel, was supposed to have been, was designed as would be the place for this rabbinical court, which would be the authoritative body. When the person who was trying to put this together was challenged, you know, by those who in the opposition, and said, and the challenger said, we know that there are people that perhaps are qualified, eminently qualified in terms of their intelligence. But where are you going to find people of high integrity? Where are you going to find the soine votza, those who hate ill money from ill-begotten gains? Where are you going to find people like that? And the answer, for money, you could find anyone. What about the factor of family? How does family play? What kind of a role does family play? In choosing the judges themselves, as long as the judges meet the first two qualifications, are the descendants of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, those are the descendants of they're Jews. They're not the product of an adulterous or incestuous relationship. They're kosher to be judges. Their father, their grandfather, did not have to be a judge himself, did not have to be a particular great saint or a scholar. He could be theoretically, from generations of scoundrels. But yet if he meets the first two criteria of that, the evident qualities of humility, of wisdom, of demeanor, and those internal qualities of integrity, he's kosher to be a judge. However, we do find that perhaps not so much in judgeships, but in other areas, that having zechus avos, having the merits of one's fathers, is important. It does play a role. Also, quoting from the Seder that we heard today, in the Aseres HaDibros, in the Ten Commandments, we have, says this is in Exodus and Shemos, says this is in chapter 20 and verse 6. Boisachesed la'alofim, and God does kindness to 1,000 generations. In other words, the person lo'oy havai to who? To those who love God. L'shomer mitzvos, of those who guard his commandments. In other words, if you have one person who loves God, who guards his commandments, there's a special favoritism which is shown to his posterity, his or her posterity, for 1,000, 2,000 generations. That's hus avos. That's the merit of the forefathers. Of course, when one, in terms of the afterlife, the ultimate judgment, one is judged on one's own merits. But in terms of the breaks one gets in life, very often breaks are handed to the posterity as a form of kindness and repayment for the Zaydas, for the forefathers, who were such spiritual people. This is schus avos. This is the merit of the forefathers. We find another example of the role of avos, of the forefathers. There's a Gemara in Bava Metzia, in Pehe Omad Aleph, in 85a, where it states that if there are three generations of scholars, people who are devoted to the study of Torah, it's much easier for their posterity to access Torah. Torah machazeres al achsanya shelo. The Torah goes back on the inn that housed it. So you have, in other words, it's easier to learn. It comes in a little easier. But yichus, in other words, this idea of coming from a prestigious family, it could be 1,000 generations before, and it doesn't have to be just necessarily one's father, one's grandfather, is a two-edged sword. There's a Gemara Menachos in Nun Gimel Amud Aleph in 53a, where someone came to Rabbi Preda. Rabbi Preda is well known for another incident, and maybe I just share it with you. Rabbi Preda had a student who no one should have such a student. He could not assimilate the information he was teaching him, and he was teaching him on a one-to-one basis. It was a private tutorial. And up to 400 times he taught the student till he finally got it. One day, Preda told the student, this is a Gemara in Erevin, in Undalad Amud Beis, in 54b. Preda says, you know, I have an appointment, I have something. He says, you know, please try to pay attention because I have to leave soon. So he gave him the 400 times and it didn't go in. You know, and he says, you know, why is today different? He says, you know, every time you taught me, I was afraid you're going to leave right now. Now you're going to leave. He says, I could concentrate. So he went over and said, don't worry, I'm not leaving until you know it. And he went over another 400 times until finally he got it. And the Gemara says, a bas kol, a voice from heaven came out and said, says Rabbi Preda, says, I'm giving you two choices. Do you want to live 400 years? This is a reward for this tremendous patience you show. Or do you want to marry you and your whole generation should go to the world to come? So he said, I want me and my generation. And he was granted actually both. And he lived to be 400 years old. Some phenomenal, I mean, the Talmud is testifying. And it wasn't because he ate yogurt. You know, was it? So to this Rabbi Preda, evidently saw a lot in life. To this Rabbi Preda, a visitor came in, and his servant, you know, someone was knocking on the door, and his shamish, his gabbai, his servant came to Preda, and he says, there's someone who wants to see you. His name is Rabbi Ezra, who is the grandson of Rabbi Avtulmus, who is a 10th generation from Rabbi Elozer ben Azariah. Elozer ben Azariah is going to be the subject of the next lecture. who is a 10th generation from Ezra the scribe. That was the subject of a previous lecture of the last series. So, you know, he says, what's Machman Azatzimis? You know, I mean, what's the big deal? He says, if he's a Bar Orion, if he's a Ben Torah, if he's, you know, someone who's immersed in Torah, Yahweh, that's fine. Im Bar Orion, Bar Avon, if he's a person who has the Torah and he's from, you know, fathers, from this Yichus, Yahweh V'Yahweh, it's even better because he has not only the Torah, but he has also the schusovus, the merit of the forefathers, either both the idea of the chesed for 2,000 generations, and also the ease, you know, to learn Torah. But he bar avon. But if he's a person with yichus, from this family, v'la bar orion, and he's not a ben Torah, says isha tichle, may fire consume him. It was evidently he's a shame on his family. So they assured him, now he's a Bar Orion, yes. Okay, so let him come. He's a Ben Torah, he's a person immersed with Torah. Says, yeah, okay, let him come in. But evidently, it could be a real debit coming from a prestigious family. Here, so we generally, there's a general saying that Yichus, a family, is like zeros. You may amass a lot of zeros, but it's just nothing. If you put a one in front, you put a digit, you put a one in front of all those zeros, then it's meaningful. But if you don't add your own in front of all of it, it's nothing. You see from the Gemara Menachos, it's worse. It says, those aren't just zeros, they're minuses. And if you don't do something yourself, says that you really, it really having yichus is a tremendous responsibility. So we find that yichus, in other words, a family does play some sort of a role, perhaps not in the appointment directly of judgeships, but it does play a role in a person's life. However, there are two examples we're going to find where actually coming from a family does matter, even in appointments of leadership. One is, as it relates to an incident that we're going to describe later in this lecture, and we're going to describe at length in the next lecture. The Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, this is the subject of the next lecture, was chosen to be the head of the Sanhedrin, the head of the yeshiva. The major factor was his family. And we're going to see why that made a difference. And we're going to discuss this a little later. The second is in really day-to-day halacha. Really not just one incident that happened in history, but something which has constantly occurred. Even though family may not be a critical consideration in the original appointment of a judge, or of a communal leader. However, with the passing of that leader, his children have come first in the choice. If his child is perhaps not the equal in wisdom of the father, but the equal in Yirah Shamayim, these inner qualities, as we discussed, not perhaps the obvious qualities, but in the inner qualities, the integrity, the Yirah Shamayim, the fear of heaven, then that child is chosen above all the others. And if a person has several children, and the oldest has the quality, not necessarily is the wisest child, but he at least fills the role of his father in terms of the integrity of the father, the God-fearing qualities of the father, then the child assumes the role of the deceased father before all others. Even though others may be more qualified in terms of their wisdom, but there is the idea of Yerusha, of inheritance. It applies not only to kings, but as the Sifri, the Halachic Medrash points out, that it applies really to all appointments of leadership. And this the Rambam brings in the first chapter of Hilchos Melachim in the Book of Kings. He states this halacha, and it's brought in Shulchan Aruch in Reish Mem Hei, in chapter 245, says this is brought lahalacha. This is the ruling in choosing leaders. There is a question that may not apply necessarily for appointment of a professorship, you know, as a professor of a Rosh Yeshiva. As we're doing strictly with wisdom, and more perhaps in a position of a leader, as it used to be a rabbi in Europe who not only was the teacher but actually was the leader of the community and could impose punishments and would be the head of the. Is it really one led in a judicial in a legislative role? As it really was the word of law was contained in this person. That which would be just perhaps a teaching position, there's a question if the heir would not meet all the qualifications of the deceased. We don't rely on the fact as well. Maybe the heir will eventually learn. I mean, it's too critical. We need the wisdom right now. In fact, Rabbi Chonam Wasserman points out. That Rav Ashi, who was the major editor of the Talmud, when he passed away, his son, who eventually became the Rosh Yeshiva many years later, was not chosen the head of the yeshiva. Because Rav Ashi's role, when the Sanhedrin really was no longer in effect, was more of a teacher. But when it comes to a teacher, we need the person who can fill the role right now in the teaching. But in a position like perhaps the Nasi of the Sanhedrin, where the Sanhedrin was really an authoritative body, and the leader of the Sanhedrin had real power, then the law applies that the child, the oldest child, fills the role, fills the shoes of the deceased in integrity, takes the place even though he is not as wise. In fact, this actually occurred when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the editor of the Mishnah, passed away. This is approximately the year 190 of the Common Era. When he passed away, he had two sons. He had a son, Gamliel, who was he was a Yorei Shamayim, he was a person of integrity, having qualities of being God-fearing, but he was not the brightest son. And he had a younger son, Shimon, who was actually the Chochem, was the wisest. In fact, throughout the Talmud, there's recorded conversations between Shimon, the younger son of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Yehuda the prince, and his father. Such discussions in Halacha are not recorded with the older son, Gamliel. However, when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi died on his deathbed, he said that his oldest son should take over the position of Nasi, of the prince, because it was a political position. The position of Chochem, of the sage of the Sanhedrin, that was given to Shimon, the younger son. So we do have a situation where someone will have the position of Nasi, which is really the highest position, but yet may be less qualified than many others. And we're dealing again with a person of integrity, but not necessarily of the wisdom. Very often in situations like that, it creates the appointment of a son to fill the shoes of the father, where the son is not the equal of the father, creates all kinds of tensions. We find this in the Hasidic world. In Hasidic dynasties, when the Hasidic Rebbe, when the Rebbe passes on, and very often it goes to the son, the older Hasidim, The Hasidim, the followers of the old Rebbe, the deceased Rebbe, very often have a problem in becoming followers of the new one. He's much younger. They don't feel he's as qualified. And very often, the old Hasidim leave the new Rebbe. And the Rebbe builds up his own new following. Because there's a real problem, to bend oneself to someone that one does not feel is to be an intellectual superior. The dynamics that are involved in choosing a leader who has the yichus, who has the family, but not necessarily all the qualifications, is real. Those dynamics are really the base of understanding the subject of tonight's lecture, Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel, this is the subject of tonight's lecture, was the fifth generation of Hillel. And let me just go back a little to Hillel and his family. Hillel became the Nasi of the Sanhedrin, became the prince of the Sanhedrin, approximately year 31 before the Common Era, 100 years before the destruction of the Temple. He was not from Eretz Yisrael. He was not from Palestine, Israel. He was from Bavel. He was a Babylonian. But for 40 years, the last 40 years of his life, from the year 80 to the year 120, he lived to be 120, he led the Sanhedrin. When he passed away, approximately the year 10 of the Common Era, his son, Shimon, became the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin, the prince, the head of the Sanhedrin. Very little is known of Shimon. We only know even of his existence from a casual comment in the Talmud, there's a Gemara in Shabbos, in 15a, Tesvav Amud Aleph, which just relates the history of the family of Hillel and names Shimon as a son. We have no sayings from him. There's nothing recorded that he was responsible for any legislation. And in all probability, since Hillel died at the year 120, Shimon, which in all probability was the oldest son, was quite old himself. Hillel was blessed with this unusually long life. The Sifrei compares his life to that of Moses, of Moshe Rabbeinu. All probability, his son Shimon did not live as long. So, again, we can only theorize because we only have almost nothing to work with. But in all probability, Shimon's reign as the prince of the Sanhedrin was very short-lived. Shimon's successor was Rabban Gamliel the first. Much is known of Rabban Gamliel. Not only is it recorded, his name is recorded in the Talmud on many occasions, but it's recorded in the New Testament as well, very favorably. When he died, and it seems, again, we don't have the exact dates, but piecing together, it seems close to the time of the destruction of the temple. This first Rabban Gamliel's son was Shimon. He's known as Shimon ben Gamliel, the first. Well, I say the first because in that family, the names of Shimon and Gamliel are going to crop up again. This Rabban Gamliel was this first, and his son Shimon ben Gamliel were the subject of the second lecture of this series. This Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel was one of the first of the 10 martyrs. After the death of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, the reins of leadership were not immediately passed down to Rabban Shimon's son. And the one that we find recorded as the leader in the period around the destruction of the temple and shortly thereafter was Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the subject of the third and fourth lecture of this series. after Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai passed away, it seems that Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's son Gamliel, in other words, this is the fifth generation, this is the second Gamliel ben Shimon. So first we have Hillel, and then we have Shimon, then we have Gamliel, Shimon, and now Gamliel. This is the fifth generation, the second Gamliel. He is known, just as Rashi seems to describe him, that we should know who he was, is Gamliel ben Shimon HaNerag. This is Gamliel, the son of Shimon, who was killed. That's that Shimon, in distinction to the first Shimon that we know very little about. The colleagues of this Rabban Gamliel were Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, the famous disciples of Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai. These were the subject of the last two lectures. And it seems both of them were superior to Rabban Gamliel as in terms of their wisdom. Even Rabbi Akiva, who was originally considered himself a disciple of Rabban Gamliel's, as history would seem to consider also Rabbi Akiva superior of Rabban Gamliel. So here Rabban Gamliel had with him, as people technically under him, scholars that outshone him. But yet Rabban Gamliel had to maintain his position under these circumstances as the Nasi, as the prince of the Sanhedrin. Having Rabbi Akiva under you is a hard act. It's just very, very difficult. So here we find that Rabban Gamliel had all the good qualities that come with Yichus, with the family. After all, says, he came from such a prestigious line of people. The Torah, you say, came back to its inn. The Torah machzeres al-achsanya shelo. The Torah, says, came back to a hospitable, the hospital's environment. But despite all these fine qualities that he had, and he was one of the great of his generation, one of the great scholars, but he had to maintain his control in a very difficult situation. And it's with that background, that light, I would like now to begin going over the sources. Okay? On page one, I just quote, and you can look over yourself. Instances where we find this Rabban Gamliel, the second, quoting his grandfather, Rabban Gamliel the first. In the third citation, C, we find him quoting an incident that happened to his own father. Here's a person who just is not quoting a teacher, but he's quoting his parents, his grandparents. Torah was part and parcel of his whole family. And he built his yeshiva, he headed it in the city of Yavna. As we've related before, it seems, historians, that actually Yavna became a center of Torah while the Beis HaMikdash, while the temple was still standing. And it seems that the move from Yerushalayim, moving the Sanhedrin from Yerushalayim to Yavna, to the small towns, was made in the lifetime of this Rabban Gamliel's grandfather, Rabban Gamliel the First. But the yeshiva flourished under the leadership of Rabban Gamliel the Second, the grandson. And it's known, as we just quote here, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, this is in the second parasha, this is Yavna, that there's a whole listing of the leaders of various cities. If one wants to have a question adjudicated, one should go only to the best. You go to Rabbi Eliezer in Lud, Lida, Rabbi Yechaman Zakkai, Baror Chayil, that was the city where he lived in. As the yeshiva may have been in Yavna, but, or in different places, but this is the city where he recited. Rabbi Yeshua to Pekin, Rabbi Gamliel to Yavna. This was his city. He was the leader of the court. And his position of leader, we find various instances of the various quotations about the different situations he had to deal with. One is a fascinating story. This is the first on page 2, paragraph A. Let me just quote this. This is there's another version, but which is not mentioned, Rabbi Gamliel by name, in the Gemara in Bava Kamma, in the Talmud Bavli, in 38a, in Lamed Chesamad Aleph. But this is from Yerushalmi in Bava Kamma. There was an incident that the government sent 2 spies to learn Torah for Rabbi Gamliel. They wanted to see if there was anything in the Torah that would be counter to the Roman government. Because again, they were always fearful of revolt. They learned from him scripture, Mishnah, Talmud, Halachas, Agoda, and it's quite likely, it's not clear if he was aware that they were non-Jews when they came, or they only revealed themselves later. When they were finished, as they departed from him, they said to him, "Is all of your Torah is beautiful and praiseworthy," as they were really impressed with him. We have another incident, which is a sense of Rabbi Gamliel, who he was. When he was going on a trip, and it seems to deal with the various problems with the Jewish community vis-a-vis Rome. So Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Akiva were walking on the road. And they heard the noise of the crowds at Rome from the Hebrew reads Plata, but the seems to be a city Puteoli in 120 miles meal from Rome. And they sensed that in the commotion of the Roman Empire and all their success, and they started crying. I mean, they were crying to see the success of all those that have crushed them. And Rabbi Akiva was happy, and this is something we're going to get back to in the last lecture of this series on Rabbi Akiva. And they said to him, "How could you be happy?" So Rabbi Akiva applied to him, "Why are you crying?" And he says, the heathens, they bow down to images, they burn incense to idols, but they live in safety and ease. They have atzlocha and brocha. We, says our Beis HaMikdash, which was the Hadoim Raglov, this is the footstool of God. This was the place of Ishchina, is burnt down by fire. Why shouldn't we weep? We look at the contrast of their success and our tragedy. And he replied, he says, "That's why I'm happy. Because if they that offend him fare thus, if Hashem could grant such grace to evildoers who are really not worthy, how much better shall fare they that do obey him?" And as eventually we'll get our reward. And we'll see the reward is given for those, the violators, how well they're treated. You can imagine how those who really deserve it should be treated. I mean, it would be probably the equivalent if one, in prisons, there are different gradations of prisons. And that there's a high security prison. And there's really something which needs very little security. In fact, people who are convicted of white-collar crimes are very often housed in quite luxurious facilities. If you go to a minimum security facility and you'd see their beds and their, you know, and their sports facilities, and you have a sense of, you know, these are offenders. These are, and they get all this good treatment. Imagine what the President of the United States gets. That, in a sense, is what Rabbi Akiva felt. That's true, but, you know, these are what offenders of the law get. You know, can imagine those who uphold the law with their place, if not now, but will eventually be. But it does give us an instance of the feelings of the period. And Rabbi Gamliel headed the delegation. He's mentioned first. That's when they all went to Rome. He was the one first. And here, if you see the quotes, we find this is in the paragraph C. Again, this is, I'm not quoting the incident, but again, we have a whole delegation. Rabbi Gamliel's leading the delegation. On page 3, there's a fascinating story. Again, there was a delegation. They went to Rome, and they wanted to find a Jewish neighborhood. And it seems in Rome, at least it wasn't so evident they didn't see the adults on the street, but it didn't seem that they could clearly tell who was Jewish and who was not Jewish. It was just going through the street. But they went to a place and they saw little kids playing. And they were making piles of dirt. You know, they're play acting. He says, and one kid says, you know, in the land of Israel, this is what they do. And they take one pile, and he represented this would be the produce, and this should be truma. This one's given to the Kohanim, to the priests. And this pile here, it's miser. This is give the tithe that's given to the Levites, the Levi. He says, you know, they're Jews here. But they had to, we constantly find that they're always going, these delegations, they're always in Gullus. They never have a place to stay. I mean, they don't know anybody. They just know they have to go to Rome, and they have to somehow do something to influence positively the Roman government. And we do find in one instance recorded a conversation that Caesar, exactly which Caesar, but one of the Caesars had with Rabbi Gamliel. And it could, again, the dating is not certain, but it could quite likely, based on other considerations, has been Hadrian that we know that did have conversations with the sages. And in this instance here on paragraph E on page 3, the emperor said to Rabbi Gamliel, says, you maintain that upon every gathering of 10, as wherever there's 10, the Shekhinah rests. He says, how many Shekhinahs are there? In other words, how could the Shekhinah, the divine presence, how could it be here and there and the other place? How many places could it be? So Rabbi Gamliel called his servant, as and he tapped him on the neck, says, you know, how do you let the sun shine in Caesar's house? There's a question, I just want to say that there's really a question on the Girsa. There are really two versions. One reads Caesar, and one reads a heretic. I mean, we took the versions of Caesar. Says, how do you let him, says, how could you let such a thing? The sun shines on Caesar's house. How do you let such a thing? He says, you know, what do you want from me? The sun shines everywhere. You know? So he says, you know, so Rabbi Gamliel commented, you know, the sun shines, the sun is only one of the servants of the creation of God, and it shines everywhere. So the Shekhinah also shines everywhere. So the Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, who 150 years ago was the most prominent rabbi in Germany, prominent scholar in Germany. He's the author of a commentary on the Talmud, Oruch Laner. Yeah. So in one of the first responsa, the Binyan Sion explains this passage of the Talmud. He says, light, you know, the sun shines all over, but if the shutters are closed and the curtains are closed, the house is dark. The sun is shining, but you're not letting it in. You open the curtains, you open the windows, you let the sun shine in. He says, the Shekhinah is everywhere, but only come in where you let him in. He says, when you have a people devoted to Torah, says, the Shekhinah comes in. It's all over. It's all shining. But you have to open up the windows. You have to let it come in. But this was the reply the Rabbi Gamaliel gave to Caesar. We find another very illuminating discussion the Rabbi Gamaliel had with what seems to be a pagan philosopher. It was on page 4. A philosopher asked Rabbi Gamaliel, and it's written in your Torah, says, the Lord your God is Eish Oichlo, it's a jealous God. Says, why is he so jealous of the worshippers? You know, why isn't he jealous of the idol, you know? Why does he have to go to war against those that worship these idols? Let him go to war with the idol itself. So he says, let me give you a mushel, give me a parable. He says, this is like a king who had a son, and the son reared a dog, you know, raised the dog, and he gave his dog the name of the father. You know, and whenever he took an oath, he says, by the life of my dog, and he said his father's name. Well, the father, you know, took offense to this. But who is he angry at? Is he angry at the son or is he angry at the dog? He's angry at the son. So he says, you know, the son, the people created this thing. The idol is just a piece of nothing. So the philosopher replied, says, will you call the idol a dog? You know, there's a reality to it. Like, you know, there's something to it. It's not just, there's power to these idols. So Rabbi Gamaliel says, what's your proof? So the pagan says, you know, a fire broke out in our city, and the whole town was burnt, with the exception of a certain, you know, idolatrous shrine. And it was the Beis Avoy de Zora. This pagan temple remained whole. So you see there's something to it. So again, Rabbi Gamaliel says, let me give you another parable. He says, you know, what's this compared to? He says, a human king, all the provinces rebelled. So who does he fight with? With the living or the dead? Does he go and burn the graveyards, or he goes and fights against the people? He fights against the people. So the flesh is what you call, first you call the idol a dog, then you call it dead, you know, so it burns down. There's no reason to burn that thing down because there's nothing there anyway. So if it's nothing, so let him destroy it from the world, you know, let him just rid it. You know, it's a whole stumbling block. It's a whole problem here. So let God destroy all these idols, and people will... says, you know, if the only thing that was worshipped would just be this big stone, you know, that they carve out, that would be... But, you know, that's not the only thing they worship. They worship the sun, the moon, the stars, planets. They brooks, valleys, and as you name it, they worship it. What, are you going to destroy the whole world? So what they make, but the ones who are held accountable are the people themselves. That conversation was recorded. It's a fascinating, also, there's a lesson in human nature. Because the Roman general Agrippa asked Rabbi Gamaliel, it's written in your Torah, another conversation. You know, again, you know, your God is devouring fire. And evidently he's jealous. He's angry at those who worship other gods. He says, what is he? Is a wise man jealous of any but a wise man? Is you're jealous of somebody who's who's on your level? A warrior is jealous of a warrior, and this who outdoes him. This is a wise man of another wise man. Of a rich man, as he compares his status and wealth, he's jealous of another wealthy person. Says, what is he jealous? What does he care about what these people do? Let me give you a more. Evidently, he was a teacher par excellence. says, let me give you another mushel, another parable. He says, what's this like? A man marries another wife. So basically his question was, why is God so concerned that they took to worship this idol? What does it bother him? It's a nothing. It's not competition. What does he care about the idol? I mean, that was the question. So he says, I'll explain this. He's with the following example. He says, someone marries another wife. If the second wife is her superior, it's no longer practice, you don't have to worry. Yeah, if the second wife is her superior, the first will not be jealous of her. There's a feeling, she feels inferior, but it's not the sense of offense. But if the second one is inferior, so basically you dropped me to take her, so then the first wife will have these terrible feelings. It's the idea of the insult. In other words, who are you taking to replace me? You're taking this. If somebody is better, you can understand, I just didn't meet the grade. You take somebody. The offense is not that I look at the God itself. In other words, this is a competitor of mine. I'm angry at the God. It's not. What I'm angry at is the people who forsook me in terms of the offense, who just dropped me for that. So he's dealing with pagans, but he's as a teacher, and this is really besides the learning that he gave us, he left us this legacy. But at least the final of this section, this is also a beautiful story. Again, of his wisdom, Rabbi Eliezer. Famous, we discussed in another lecture, had a wife, Imash Shalom, who was the sister of Rabbi Gamliel. Now, there's a certain the quote here is, there was a certain philosopher who lived in his vicinity, and it seems from the passage this philosopher really was an early Christian, and he had a reputation that he didn't accept any bribes. So they wanted to expose him. And there was a question about the inheritance, or at least that they made up this question, I don't know if it really existed, about the inheritance that the brother and sister were supposed to get. So she first brought him as a present, a bribe, a golden lamp, to this judge, this Christian who was supposed to be beyond reproach. And she came to him and says, I want a share of my father's estate. So the judge, after he gave the bribe, so the judge told her, says, right, you should divide it. Rabbi Gamliel came back to the judge and says, but in our Torah, it says that there's a son and a daughter, then the son continues on the role. The daughter marries into another family. She becomes part of that family. But the family continues on. The name of the family continues on with the son. The son inherits. The judge replied, this Christian judge, since the day that you were exiled from your land, the law of Moses has been superseded and another book given. Actually, in the censored part of the Talmud, that was taken out. This other book is referring to is the evangelical writings, Evangelion, and there's the Christian writings. Where it is written, a son and a daughter inherit equally. We have no record of this in the Christian writings, but not necessarily everything was preserved. So he says, this is part of the writings. There's a new... there's a new equality. Okay, that was his first judgment. The next day, Rabbi Gamliel brought him a Libyan donkey. It was a prize donkey. So he gave a bribe to the judge. So first she came, remember, and she brought a golden lamp. He came and brought this donkey. So he said, he called them back, said, "I've reconsidered the case." He says, "Look at the end of the book where it's written, I came not to destroy the law of Moses, nor to add to the law of Moses." I want to add, this is a Fekutza Shel Yud, not a jot, not a dash. He's not coming to add or detract. You know, the Yeshu is not coming from the Torah. And is written there, and the Torah says, a daughter is not inherit where there's a son. So therefore, I award it to the son. So Imesh Sholem wanted to allude to the judge, because they wanted to expose him. Evidently, people were in on this, and to see what. And she hinted, she says, "Let your light shine forth like a lamp." Is alluding to the lamp. Rabbi Gamliel said, "A donkey came and knocked over the lamp." So here we find, I just want to stop for a second, just through what we have. We have Rabbi Gamliel, who comes from this prestigious house, who has, we said, who has certain even traditions from that house. A person who assumed the mantle of leadership and wore it well. Who was always involved in these delegations. A person who was skilled in dealing with non-Jews. Now we're going to see about his special, the qualities that one doesn't apparently see. These hidden qualities. There was an incident here on page 5. There was an incident that the child of a neighbor of Rabbi Gamliel's died, and she was weeping all night. She was crying. Rabbi Gamliel heard this, felt her pain. He cried too. He cried with the thing that his eyelashes fell out. I mean, it was he couldn't take it. So he heard the crying, and evidently he was a very, very sensitive person. But the disciples of Rabbi Gamliel were concerned about the health of the welfare of their master, and they moved her out of the neighborhood. If they couldn't, evidently she was unconsolable, but for his health it was best that she move. But he was against a sense of his sensitivity. He was also very humble. Here we have on page 5 in paragraph B. There's a whole incident that Rabbi Gamliel's son was getting married, and he served the scholars of the generation, which he probably felt to be superior to him. As I said before, that he got the position not because of merit, even though he was a great scholar, but because of that he was from the family. And at the banquet, he actually served Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Tzadok. And there's a whole discussion amongst themselves, how can we let Rabbi Gamliel serve us? After all, he is the Nasi. Those who maintain that he was allowed to lower himself point to Avram, to Abraham, who lowered himself. But we see here's a person who didn't necessarily stand on ceremony. He felt that these people were his superiors. He has to give them the right covet. There was another incident which we quoted last time. It's on page 6. At least some of them. When Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua were on a boat trip. And Rabbi Yeshua brought with him not only bread for the boat trip, but brought with him flour as well. It's a contingency. And actually, the trip took longer than was anticipated. And the Rabbi Yeshua baked the bread and shared it with Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel wonders, how did you know that the trip would take longer than expected? And he said, you know, there's a star, evidently a comet, that comes once in 70 years. Since the sailors navigate by means of the stars, there are very often they go off course because of this. And I knew this is around the time it was supposed to come up, so I brought, just in case, I brought the extra flour. And Wilson was amazed, says, you know that much? This is, you know, you have such a difficulty. Evidently, Rabbi Gamliel had a different purpose than going on this trip. But Rabbi Yeshua was going for reasons of making a living. And he says, you have all that wisdom, you know, you still can't make a living like it, so you have to go on this, on these boat trips. He says, you're looking at me, he says, you have disciples that are far wiser than I am. And he quotes Lozer Chisma, Yechman Gudgoda. They know how to calculate how many drops there are in the sea, and they don't have bread to eat nor clothes to wear. And when he came, when the trip was finished, he came back, he appointed them as in a supervisor role, in a leadership role, these people, Lozer Chisma, in the yeshiva, in the Sanhedrin. And they didn't want it. You know, yeah. So he went over to them again. And he says, you think leadership is a privilege? He says, I'm not offering you leadership. I'm offering you servitude. A leader is a servant of the people. I'm giving you slavery. And quotes a posik. This is the way he looked at the position of, you know, of leadership. A leadership is a servant. But when he saw people that were qualified, he gave them the position. So here we have a picture that comes of sensitivity, of humility. Here there's an incident, the Rabbi Gamliel's son was sick, and he went to send, and there's a question which Rabbi Gamliel this is, but Rabbi Gamliel went to ask for the prayer of Chanina ben Dosa. In other words, Rabbi Gamliel felt, I don't have the saintliness that God necessarily will answer my prayers, but he didn't feel that Lafna, but I know someone who's greater than I, and he went to him. It's in this backdrop, again, of his family, of his special qualities, and his humility, that we have to understand the following very troubling incident. And we're not going to go into all the details of the time, but we're going to quote some of the important points here. There was a question. The beginning of this story starts off with a halachic discussion. Is the prayer of Ma'ariv, of the evening prayer, is it as compulsory as the other prayers, Shacharis, the morning prayer, and Mincha, the afternoon prayer? There's a question if it, according to some commentaries, it may have been totally optional. Today, it's really not a question, because as pointed out, the minhag, the custom is that at least for men, that davening Ma'ariv, davening the evening prayer, has become a minhag, has become a custom. But before the Talmud is speaking about a different era, where it not has yet become basically the fixed custom. And it was a question, but is it a requirement or is it merely optional? There was one disciple that came to Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua, which was the subject of last time's lecture, was the Av Beis Din. I mean, had a, at least according to the Talmud Bavli, that was his position. It was a high position in the Sanhedrin, only second to the Nasi himself, the prince. Rabbi Gamliel got that position because of the family. Rabbi Yeshua's position was because of merit. He asked Rabbi Yeshua, and Rabbi Yeshua's position was that it was optional. That was his position. The same student wanted to hear the opinion of Rabbi Gamliel and asked the same question of Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel disagreed with Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Gamliel said, it's compulsory, as one is required to daven Ma'ariv, the evening prayer, just as one is required to daven Shacharis and Mincha. So the student blurted out, you know, I just asked Rabbi Yeshua, and he said it's optional. With that, Rabbi Gamliel took offense. And it seems, even the commentaries don't, and this is really subject of a lot of discussion, what the dynamics of the story is, it would seem there is a halacha that a Talmud, a student, is not allowed to make rulings in the place of the Rav, in place of the Rebbe, of the teacher. That's a deference to the teacher. Rabban Gamliel was not the teacher of Rabbi Yeshua, not formally the teacher. After all, Rabbi Yeshua's teacher was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So he wasn't really his teacher. And for all that, in all probability, Rabbi Yeshua was even the intellectual superior of Rabban Gamliel. Even though Rabban Gamliel was one of the greatest scholars of the time, but yet Rabbi Yeshua was probably his intellectual superior. But in terms of the hierarchy, in terms of the position, Rabban Gamliel was the superior of Rabbi Yeshua. And Rabbi Gamliel felt, because of his superior position, all the respect that's afforded a Rebbe, a teacher, should be afforded to him as well. Simply because of his rank, not necessarily because on his own merits. Rabbi Yeshua felt that that law only applies strictly to teachers and students, rather than just positions. And after, from Rabbi Gamliel's vantage point, it was very critical that his position be treated with the highest respect. Because you have to realize that the colleagues of Rabban Gamliel were really his intellectual superiors. I mean, in all probability, they were his intellectual superiors. So it was very important for him to maintain this position. And if it somehow would be eroded, then others would look at him, well, you know, who is he? You know, we'll give all our respect to Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yeshua. So to maintain his position, it was very important that the office of Nasi be given all the trappings that really a Rebbe deserves. I mean, that was Rabban Gamliel's position. Otherwise, then who am I? Again, one has to realize, we're taking the back, that he got his position by virtue of he was the son of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, he was a descendant of Hillel. He did not get it because the masses felt he is the very best for the job. So here was the question. Rabbi Yeshua felt, I'm not his Talmud, I'm not his disciple. I give him, there's a lot of deference that's given to the Nasi, to the prince. But in terms of paskening, in terms of ruling, he does not get that privilege. The Nasi is not afforded the respect that's given a Rebbe, a teacher. Rabbi Gamliel felt otherwise. So they came. You can read the. I'll just sum this up, because Rabbi Gamliel, when the yeshiva was in session, Rabbi Gamliel had the student bring the question. And evidently, Rabbi Yeshua was aware of Rabbi Gamliel's position, the public position, Rabbi Gamliel maintained that davening Ma'ariv, the evening prayer, is compulsory. So when the question was asked, and Rabbi Gamliel made his ruling, it's compulsory, and he asked, does anyone dispute this? Rabbi Yeshua said, no, no one disputes this. Because Rabbi Yeshua felt publicly he could not take a position against them, even though he felt privately, you know. He felt, Rabbi Yeshua, that the position of the Nasi, of the prince, demanded, at least publicly in his face, one could not contradict him. However, privately, one would be allowed to contradict the Nasi, provided, of course, that the Nasi was not his own personal Rebbe, was not his superior. If it would be a superior, he's his Rebbe. To a Rebbe, to a teacher, to a master, one one does not, in even in close proximity, not just in the environs of the Rebbe, one does not make any rulings. One always defers to the Rebbe, to the teacher. Rabbi Yeshua looked at Rabbi Gamliel as not as a teacher. He's not a master of mine. However, he does have a position, and publicly, at least in his presence, he has to be afforded that honor. So in his presence, he didn't dispute his ruling. However, Rabbi Gamliel took Rabbi Yeshua to task. He says, I have someone here who can testify that you ruled to the contrary. And now Rabbi Yeshua's back was to the wall. He says, listen, now you have me. He says, I can't deny this. Yes, I did make a ruling which contradicts you. I didn't make it publicly, but I did make such a ruling. And Rabbi Gamliel felt that Rabbi Yeshua should be punished. I mean, he should be reprimanded. Because, again, understanding Rabbi Gamliel, he felt his position was tenuous. And as if he did not buttress his position as the Nasi, then no one would give him respect. That was Rabbi Gamliel's view. However, the colleagues of Rabbi Yeshua felt otherwise. And Rabbi Yeshua, a person of the stature of Yeshua, should not be reprimanded. And there was a whole revolt. And in the next lecture we'll go into more greater details about that revolt. There was a whole revolt, and they unseated him. And there's a question, who should they pick? Because they didn't feel that a person with those attitudes should not be the Nasi. And Rabbi Akiva, who would have been the most likely successor, was not chosen. Rabbi Yeshua, who would be the next in line, they felt it was just improper to pick Rabbi Yeshua, who was, it would seem that the whole thing was mastermind just because of Rabbi Yeshua, and it didn't look good. But they couldn't pick. There's a question now: who next? Rabbi Akiva was the next likely candidate. But Rabbi Akiva's father was a ger. He was a convert. He didn't have schus ovas. He didn't have the merit of the fathers. And they felt that Rabbi Gamliel, because he would be hurt, that who knows, you know, what bad could befall his successor, because if, again, the whole idea of schus ovas, we said, is this chesed, is the kindness that's given to the progeny. Well, Rabbi Akiva didn't have that source of chesed. He didn't have that. In fact, perhaps one could understand Rabbi Akiva's suffering in the light that he didn't have this chesed. He didn't have these forefathers to that all this extra kindness should be showered upon him. So the next candidate was Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who again was the 10th generation of Ezra, the scribe, was chosen. But yet, despite all of this, Rabbi Gamliel still came to the Beis Medrash. After he was deposed, he still came to learn. And he underwent the embarrassment of coming because Torah was so important in his eyes. Eventually he made up. In other words, he came to Rabbi Yeshua, and eventually Rabbi Gamliel was reinstated. And the details of that reinstatement we're going to leave for the next lecture. I would just like, though, to discuss a few points. One is, there was a major change which took place after Rabbi Gamliel was deposed. Rabbi Gamliel had a policy that he only let in a select few into be students of his, to be disciples. Misha Toichoi Kabaro, one whose inside is like the outside. In other words, he's a sincere person. Those are the only students that are allowed. Someone who's not Toichoi Kabaro, who's felt was insincere, says, can't be let in. I remember when I was in Lakewood, a friend had a Sheva Brachas. And they were speaking about the praises of the chosen of the, And he was he looked a lot worse than he was. In other words, he was a very great scholar in the Yerush Shemayim. He was a person of great integrity, but he looked terrible. And he said, he quoted this passage of the Talmud, the one who was giving the speech, and he said, you know, the Torah, they discuss only two types in the Talmud. One is tocho kabaro, in other words, one the outside looks like the inside, and the one is not tocho kabaro, his outside looks better than the inside. Here our chosen says is just the opposite. Says like this, his inside's much better than his outside. Rabbi Gamliel, when he was in a position of leadership, maintained that those standards. However, the standards were loosened when he was deposed, and as a result, says there is a whole list of that there were many, many more people who were allowed in than were before. There's on page 9 in the first chapter, one of those 400 benches were added. There's a benches full of people. Others say 700 benches were added. Why did Rabbi Gamliel have such an attitude? Why was he so careful in picking disciples? And yet, the question is not all that clear, but perhaps one could speculate that following the flow that we've gone through, there's this line of reasoning. If Rabbi Gamliel felt that it was important to buttress his position, even though he perhaps wouldn't have had the respect because inherently had, because of his qualities, and that he had many great qualities, it was very careful for him to be very selective on which students he took. Because the other students, if the students were not truly sincere, they'd give him a very hard time. Because why should I listen to you? Rabbi Kiva's here, Rabbi Shua's here. So therefore it was very important that he picked only students that he would be really sympathetic to him. We find a contrast with Hillel, who was very loose, he was very liberal in picking students. But Hillel got his position because of his merit. So there was no problem of disrespect. So perhaps this was a factor why Rabbi Gamliel was just so careful. And one could perhaps also just understand on page 12 there was an incident which is recorded with Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yeshua prior to the incident when Rabbi Gamliel was temporarily deposed. And again, Tommy, you could look at the notes. But there was a question about which day should be Rosh Hashanah. Rabbi Gamliel took one position, Rabbi Yeshua took a differing position. Rabbi Gamliel said, according to my calculations and how I've declared through the courts, it should be one day. And of course, then it follows on the 10th day of that month, Yom Kippur, which is a certain day. You maintain, since you hold Rosh Hashanah is a different day, there's a question which day should be Rosh Hashanah, your Yom Kippur comes out a different day. The day that you consider Yom Kippur and I consider not Yom Kippur, I want you to come to me wearing weekday clothing. I want you carrying your money, carrying your staff. I want you to act like on the weekdays. I want to say that my psak, my ruling is correct. And he really was very shaken by this. And there was a whole discussion that he spoke to Rabbi Akiva and he spoke to Rav Dosa ben Hurkanus, who reassured Rabbi Yeshua that really the ruling of Rabbi Gamliel is correct. But at the end, I just want to look at the end of the page here, Rabbi Yeshua finally came to Rabbi Gamliel, and Gamliel rose and kissed him on his head and said to him, come in peace. This was a boy b'sholem, my teacher, my disciple. He called him my teacher in wisdom, because he realized Rabbi Yeshua was his superior. But my disciple, because you've accepted my decision. In other words, I still, even though you're wiser than me, I have the position and in that sense you are my disciple. So it would seem that that is really the dynamics involved. And also we find here on page 13, in a similar situation where we close, with Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, was the picked his firstborn, Rabbi Gamliel, who was not the most qualified for the position. Again, in terms of his integrity, he was. His Yerushamayim, the fear of God that he had. But he did not have the qualities of wisdom that others had. And the advice Rebbe gave him was, my son, conduct your patriarchate as your nesius. You are the patriarch. You are the prince of the Sanhedrin. So first do with men of high standing. So the people around you should be of the highest caliber. So that will lift you up in the process and give credence to you, and the people around you. And also, this is Zroik Mora B'Talmidim. He says, you should that you should throw fear in the bile. You should have a fear among the students that you should make that they fear you. And it could very well be, again, that he wanted to make sure that a respect is built into the position, because otherwise, since he was not worthy, in this situation, this happened a few generations later, he wasn't worthy, he'd be stepped all over. So it's important again, and it could very well be that was the pattern of Rabbi Gamliel. The death of Rabbi Gamliel, really we touched upon in the lecture of Rabbi Eliezer, it was on page 13, just briefly, he says the Rebbe Eliezer was put into cherem, was really put in communication by the Sanhedrin, led by Rabbi Gamliel. And Rebbe Eliezer felt terrible. And Ima Sholom, which was the sister of Rabbi Gamliel, the wife of Rebbe Eliezer, always prevented her husband from saying tachanun, from falling on his face after davening. One day, Ima Sholem mistakenly thought, she was Rosh Chodesh. On Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of a new month, one does not say Tachanun, one does not fall on the face. She wasn't by his side when he finished davening, and she went to the door to give charity to the poor. In the middle, says Rebbe Eliezer fell on his face. He was crying. And then Mishalom, the wife, looked at Rebbe Eliezer and says, you can get up now. Says, I know my brother, Rabbi Gamliel, the leader of the Sanhedrin, who put you in excommunication, has died. Says, how do you know? Says, listen, you were very hurt, and I have a tradition for my father's house. Says, all gates are locked except the gates of wounded feelings. And as a result of the pain that you suffered, says, your prayers were answered, and Rabbi Gamliel died, and that he actually did die then. You could look at the time doesn't allow us, as we'll start questioning. On page 14, there's a fascinating incident where the Roman government wanted to kill Rabbi Gamliel, and he actually was saved. It's a fascinating story. Okay, next week we're going into the life of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Well, 2 weeks, the next lecture. The week we don't give the class doesn't count. Yeah. Are there any questions? Yeah. That was the grandfather of this Rebbe, father of the subject of tonight's lecture. This is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. This is Rabbi Shimon, the son of the first Rabbi Gamliel. It was the father of this Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Gamliel the second. Yeah. Are there any? Yeah.
Given that he was supposedly such a Yerushalayim, how do you figure that he would have such a problem? Was it really just the position of the personal pride issue?
No, no, that's what I wanted to show. Is that in his own life, he was a very humble person. Even in the prayer of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, he gave them the greatest respect. It was really as it wasn't a person. I mean, you see clearly from the way he acted, it wasn't a personal issue. He was a very humble person. It was the question of the position itself, because otherwise the whole position would crumble. And this is really the same advice Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi gave his son. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the editor of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda the Prince, is really known in the Talmud as really the most humble of his generation. You have somebody who's so humble, yet he tells his son, the Zroik more, but give fear to you, because he was just very concerned about the position. Now, the whole position should not dissolve. No, that was his position, but even though that was his position, his colleagues really took exception. You know? And it's like every machlokas, but we just understand his position. Yes. Yeah. Nisius, well, let me just explain. The question about the question was asked about that it was not really a position of inheritance, you mean, because it came from the mother's side of David. Let me just explain to him. As you said, Nisius is a position of power. And I said, like any position of power, it goes with Yerusha. It goes with inheritance. Up until Hillel was a descendant from the mother's side, from his mother's side. You see, Hillel himself was in the tribe of Binyamin. He was a Yerushalmi in the ninth parak of Kilayim. He was in the tribe of Binyamin. But he was a descendant from his mother's side from David HaMelech, from King David. That was just a question of the pride of the family, of the yichus, of the thing. But that has nothing to do with his legal status. His legal status was he had the position, and if the child is worthy of filling those shoes, so the child takes over the position. And that's the basis where a dynasty started. His children did not have it because they were descendants of David. They did it because they were descendants of Hillel. It just was, you know, it just added to the prestige that they actually did come, were descended in some minor way from King David, from David HaMelech. But that was not really critical to the position itself. Evidently did not have children that were really worthy of filling that position. Yes. I mean, that was a tremendous bracha that Hillel had. In fact, how Rav Isaac Alevi has it, there actually were 13 generations from the initial Hillel till the last descendant that was called Hillel the Second, who was the last head of the Sanhedrin. So let me just rephrase this question here so you understand a little better. The leaders of the Sanhedrin, the time when Hillel became the Nasi, were a family called B'nai B'Seira. When Hillel came up from Bavel and was able to rule on questions they were not able to rule on, they gave over their position to Hillel, and that's how Hillel got his position. So we find that we're willing to give this up, right? We find Rabbi Gamliel is holding strongly to this position. There are two important things to remember. First of all, the Yerushalmi quotes Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi as saying the thing that B'nai B'Seira gave up is something that even he couldn't do. It was an amazing thing that they were able to give up their position. The second one was the reason they gave up because they felt they weren't qualified for the position, because they could not answer the questions, and here was a person who could.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture.